is the last of five lectures that I have been having this week under the general title, They Knew Luther. And the man I'm talking about today is Charles V, who became, during Luther's lifetime, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. He also is the youngest of the five people that I'm talking about. He was born in 1500, which makes him 17 years younger than Luther. He was born in Ghent. At the time it was called Flanders. Today it's in Belgium. And he was of the Spanish Habsburg royal family. Now there are two branches of the Habsburg family. The one branch is the Spanish branch. The other branch is the Austrian branch. And you are probably more familiar with the Austrian branch that, at least from a ruling standpoint, ended with Emperor Franz Joseph. Well, Henry, he was born in 1500. His father is known in history as Philip the Handsome. Doesn't say much for any other Philips that happened to be living at the same time. So he was apparently the good-looking one, and he was Duke of Burgundy. Burgundy is in the center of what today is France. His mother's name was Joanna, and she was the third child of two people of whom we've all heard, Ferdinand and Isabella. They were the ones who sent Columbus to find a new route to China, and instead he found the New World. Ferdinand was king of Aragon, and Isabella was queen of Castile, which were two sections of Spain. His grandfather on his father's side, or the father of Ferdinand, was Maximilian I, who was emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, one of the peculiarities at this time about the Holy Roman Empire was that the Holy Roman Empire purported to be the same land area which at one time had been the Roman Empire. Now, actually, the Eastern Empire was not a part of the Holy Roman Empire. Matter of fact, it was controlled by Mohammedans. In addition to this, France, which supposedly was a part of the Holy Roman Empire, just plain wasn't, and it had its own king. Spain was a part of the Holy Roman Empire. What today we call Netherlands was a part of the Holy Roman Empire. Certain parts of Germany were parts of the Holy Roman Empire. And they claimed that also Italy was. Except that the Pope also claimed that he owned all of Italy. And it seems a little strange to have a Holy Roman Empire, but Italy wasn't any part of it. But anyway, that was part of the mixed up situation at the time. As a result of being born of Joanna and Philip, he was first in line to inherit the following kingdoms: Castile, Aragon, Navarre, Granada, the Kingdom of Naples, which was central Italy, Sicily, Sardinia, the Netherlands, and all Spanish possessions in the New World. That was on his mother's side. On his father's side, he was heir to all the Habsburg lands in Austria, to Hungary, to Bohemia, and to French Burgundy. His father died on the 25th of September in 1506. He was 6 years old. He was now the legitimate heir to his father's rights. His mother was insane most of her adult life. There's reason to believe that she was insane when his father married her, but he married her not for her intellect, but for her bloodlines and for her rights of possession. And so at the time that Charles was conceived, his mother was incurably insane, and of course through her entire pregnancy she was, and he was raised by nurses. He was made the ward of the Archduchess Margaret of Austria, who was also the regent of the Netherlands. For a great many years, the regent of the Netherlands was a woman from Austria. I don't know why, but it was. And at the time of the wars for Netherland independence, where William of Orange led the Protestant Calvinist Netherlanders in their battle for freedom from Catholic Spain, the regent over the Netherlands was the aunt of Philip II, who was king of Spain at the time, and she was from Austria. So there was always this Austrian control. She raised him and three sisters whom he had. Actually, he had four sisters and a brother, so there were six children. So this insane queen had six children. He and three of his sisters were raised in the Netherlands. His brother Ferdinand and his sister Catherine were raised in Spain. He was tutored by two priests, Robert of Ghent and Adrian of Utrecht. Now, Adrian of Utrecht is a particularly fascinating man. Thomas Mann wrote a novel about him once, because he's the only man we know of in history who was elected pope and refused it, was forced to be pope, and resigned after a year. So he was pope for 1 year. He was a very humble, shy man, spent most of his life in a cloister, and he was one of the tutors of Charles V. As a result of the political education which these men gave him, he was an idealist. And it's interesting that his political ideas were shaped by Dante. Now, everybody knows Dante is the author of that grand poem called The Divine Comedy, which tells us what hell and purgatory and heaven are like and who's where.
Which I've always hardly despised.
Well, Dante wrote at least one little political treatise called, it's about 20 pages long, and it's called De Monarchia, On Monarchy. It's a treatise that was written, probably about 1460, and it advocates the idea of one world government. It argued that there will be wars and there will be dissension and there will never be peace unless all of the warring factions of the world are united under one world government. Charles saw the Holy Roman Empire as the possibility for the realization of Dante's ideas. It's interesting that this kind of idea came up again in 1945 when the United Nations was being formed, and there was talk about the United Nations as being a sort of government of governments and having its own peacekeeping force and everything else. In 1515, when he was still 14 years old, because it was January, he was declared to be of age. He was now eligible to rule without advice or instruction of the regent. The following year, he was still 15, but the following year he became Charles I, ruler of Aragon and Castile. So he became king of the two areas of Spain which had been ruled by his grandparents, Ferdinand and Isabella, who sent Columbus to the New World. He went to Spain to rule over Spain. On the way, he visited his mad mother in the insane asylum where she was. He had never seen her before. He also visited his brother Ferdinand, who was about a year younger than he was, and he'd never seen him before either. All right, he gets to Spain, and just about the same time, Emperor Maximilian I died. As a result of this, he was now automatically Archduke of Austria and one of the candidates to succeed his grandfather Maximilian as Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. The seven electors, one of whom was Frederick of Saxony, you know, the political ruler of the land where Luther lived, the seven electors met to elect the next emperor. The majority of them were against him, were against Charles V. One of the people who came to where they were meeting and debating the matter, of course, was the man we talked about on Wednesday, Cardinal Cajetan, who had interviewed Luther at Augsburg and attempted to solve the Luther problem. He strongly supported the cause of Charles V. The other candidates who were being considered at the time were Henry VIII of England, Frederick of Saxony, that was Luther's boss, Charles I, King of France. Now, Henry VIII and Charles I kind of neutralized one another because the French forces didn't want an English king to be emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and the English forces and their friends in the Netherlands didn't want a French king. So they kind of neutralized one another. Frederick the Elector was one of the electors, and he didn't want it. And so, in a sense, they almost by default, they started thinking about Charles. And one of the obvious reasons why they weren't considering him was the fact that the guy was 16 years old. You know, he's still growing up. And to put him in charge of a kind of amorphous empire, which really boiled down to try to getting all of these little petty kings to get along with one another and fight with one another. It was a kind of a reconciling role. And they just didn't see this young kid as having what it took to play that role. Well, the Habsburg family did a little backroom wheeling and dealing and slipped a little money here and made promises there. And lo and behold, one day Charles V wakes up and discovers he's the next Holy Roman Empire. It cost the family 850,000 gold gulden, which is a few million dollars. They borrowed it from the Fuggers family of Vienna, who also happened to be the group that had loaned the money to Albert of Mainz, got him his three bishoprics and the cardinalate, and it got Tetzel out selling indulgences to pay the loan back. See, same brokers. In 1520, January 23rd, Charles, 19 years of age, he is crowned King of the Holy Roman Empire in the cathedral at Aachen. The cathedral which Charlemagne had built and where Charlemagne was buried, and where traditionally the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was crowned, because Charlemagne was the first of the emperors. His empire was held together by a series of dynastic marriages, almost like a spider web, and he arranged some more to make his power stronger, and I've got a list of the marriages that he arranged. He arranged that his sister Isabella marry King Christian II of Denmark, that his brother Ferdinand marry Anne of Hungary and Bohemia. Nobody pulled off any deal like this again until Napoleon came along and married off all of his in-laws to all the crown heads of Europe that he could marry him to. Sister Mary was married to Louis II of Hungary, Catherine, John III of Portugal, Eleanor to Francis I of France. He himself married Isabella of Portugal. They were engaged on and off about eight times before they finally got married. His aunt Catherine of Aragon was already married to Henry VIII, so that took care of his English connection until Henry got rid of her and then there were problems. He married off his son Philip, who would become Philip II of Spain, to Mary Tudor, who was the first or the second heir after Henry VIII, after Edward. Well, Edward didn't last long. Mary became queen. Philip stayed in Spain. Mary stayed in England. Mary died a few years later. Then they tried to marry him to Elizabeth, because she was the next one coming along. And Elizabeth wouldn't have anything to do with that greasy Spaniard, even though he came and romanced her. And but all along there were efforts made by means of these marriages to form alliances and to protect the Holy Roman Empire. He married his niece Christina of Denmark to Duke Sforza II of Milan. He married his sister-in-law Beatrice of Portugal to the Duke of Savoy, and there were some more distant relatives that he married off to other people also. So he was a marriage broker, among other things, for political reasons, to get everything set up to protect the empire and also to work in the direction of producing a world government and to eliminate war. Well, I think one of the surprising things about history is that most of the people who tried to eliminate war have spent almost their entire political careers involved in one war after another, and he was one of them. One of Napoleon's intentions was to reestablish the Holy Roman Empire, with himself, of course, as emperor, spent his entire career in warfare. Adolf Hitler had some ideas the same kind of way. Create a united Europe, one country. Bring it off by conquering everybody or by getting everybody married to everybody else of the ruling people. He thought of himself as the arbiter of Europe, that his responsibility was to keep the empire at peace with itself, with local rule, local decisions, having problems solved as close to the local place as possible, in his role as a kind of benevolent, genteel administrator who keeps everything smooth and operating well. He was of the belief that what would unify the empire was a common faith. And so consequently, when the Luther trouble came along, and then when the Hutterite trouble came along, and the Zwingli trouble came along, and the Calvin trouble came along, all of these things he responded to politically because they were disruptive of his political beliefs. And I suspect that to a greater extent than we give him credit for, many of his decisions about Luther and others were made for reasons of political effect rather than religious effect. The Reformation, of course, destroyed all of his plans. The Spaniards didn't like him. They called him the foreigner. He couldn't talk Spanish. He was gone most of the time. One of the ironies of his rule was that Spain, which supposedly was home grounds for him, was the part of his empire that he had the least control over, and at the same time, those who were most obedient to him and with whom he got along best and who were most loyal to him were the Germans, whom he was trying to destroy theologically. And it's very strange that those who supported him politically were those whom theologically he tried to wipe out. And those that he had trouble with were the Spaniards, who supposedly were his people, and the Pope and his forces, who were constantly fighting him on the political front. Okay. He spent the early years of his rule putting down revolts in Spain as the Spaniards were trying to throw him out as their king. And he was not really successful with Spain and got Spain pacified until his son Philip II became king. He deliberately raised his son in Spain. He saw to it that his son talked Spanish as well as other languages, and that he conversed with his people in Spanish, and the Spanish people identified with Philip and were very supportive of him, and Philip II was the great Spanish king in the years when Spain was the greatest country in the world. He, from the years 1516 to 1598, or virtually the whole 16th century, Spain had two kings, Charles V and Philip II. And it was during those years that Spain gathered most of its wealth from the New World, from Mexico and Peru and some of the other South American countries, and it became the greatest 16th century power in the whole world. On the theological front, Charles I and then Philip introduced the Inquisition, led by the Dominicans. They put down all civil and ecclesiastical disobedience, and they unified Spain. Matter of fact, Spain is probably the only country in Europe which still has the Inquisition, and which still permits only one religion to be at least officially practiced, and that's Roman Catholicism. When the Spanish Armada was defeated in 1588 by the sailors of the girl that Philip had wanted to marry, Elizabeth, this was the beginning of the decline of Spain. At the end of the century, the British had knocked off the Spanish and the French had moved to the front. France and the Turk were Charles' greatest enemy. The reason why France was Charles's problem was the fact that here was Spain, part of his empire. Here were the Spanish Netherlands, Germany, Hungary, Austria, and so on. And in between the two was France. And the only way he could get from one to the other was by the Mediterranean, in which case he had to cross the Alps and go down to Italy, which he didn't control, or by the Atlantic and the English Channel, and the British controlled the English Channel. So it was extremely difficult for Charles to get from one part of his empire to the other part of his empire, or to move troops from one to the other. He had France in the middle, he had Italy to the south, and he had Great Britain to the north, and off to the east, he had the Turks, who were constantly moving westward. So it was an extremely difficult kingdom to control. I suppose in a sense it's sort of comparable to the situation that Pakistan had before the India-Pakistan War, which detached the eastern part and made it a separate country. Because Pakistan just couldn't control both parts of the country. The Indians were between, and the Indians wouldn't let them go back and forth, nor would they let them fly across, so you had to go all the way around India to get from one side to the other side, and it was just an impossible situation. Well, that's what Charles had also. Germany was composed of almost 400 tiny little kingdoms held loosely together in a sort of confederation. Charles got his brother Ferdinand appointed head of the confederation and tried to keep the German states loyal to him in that kind of way. 1521, Charles is only 20 years old. The Diet of Worms is convened. Charles' first imperial diet. Martin Luther is the prime item on the agenda. So you got a 20-year-old man deciding whether or not Luther is a heretic. A young fellow. Luther is 33. The emperor is 20 years old. He outlawed Luther because he believed that Luther was a threat to the Pope, that he was a divisive influence, and that he might lead people to rebel against him. And what he was most concerned about was Luther's teachings about the freedom of the Christian man. And he couldn't afford to permit people to be free and make their own decisions. Within the year, the Knights Revolt occurred, when a great many German knights organized and fought against him, led by Franz von Sickingen, Ulrich von Hutten, and it took about a year to wipe out that rebellion. Then came, a year later, came the Peasants' Revolt, and it took a year to wipe out that rebellion. And so Charles having been involved in two wars in Germany. Francis I of France thought, yeah, the guy's weakened. He's still a kid. He isn't even 25 years old yet. He's hated by the Germans because he's fought two wars against him. Now's my time to move. And so he began moving across the French Riviera and the Italian Riviera and tried to take over Lombardy, which is the northern, northwestern part of Italy. Charles fought against him together with the Pope, and they caught Francis at Pavia, which is near Milan. As a result of being captured, he had to buy his freedom back and go back to Paris. So he gave up all of his claims to Italy. Part of central France around Burgundy, where Charles had come from, was given up, and two of his sons became hostages of the empire to keep Francis in line. In 1526, the German princes were beginning to get extremely suspicious of Charles, particularly of his religious decisions, and they met at Torgau to form a league for mutual support against him. Francis was now free and back in France, and he thumbed his nose at Charles, tore up the treaty he had made with him, made an alliance with the new Pope Clement VII, with Venice, the free city of Venice, the free city of Florence, and with Henry VIII. So they had Charles pretty well surrounded. The Germans were in rebellion against him, the British to his north, the Italians to his south, France in the middle. They all were going to fight against him. What happened? Charles won. Henry VIII sat at home. Francis lost. The Pope Charles moved down into Italy. He conquered the city of Rome. He caught the Pope, stuck him in prison. This is when Carlo Caetano ended up in jail too, and had to buy his way out, and it took him the rest of his life to pay off his debts. And Charles now had control of Italy. He had weakened France, he had control of Italy. England was standing back and being very, very careful, you know, making threatening noises but doing nothing. And Charles, probably this was the high point of Charles' control of Europe. One of the conditions that was laid down by Charles was that in return for his releasing the Pope from prison, the Pope would crown him, thereby giving the official sanction of the church to the legitimacy of his rule. And at Bologna in 1530, the Pope crowned him King of Lombardy, northern Italy, thereby giving up his own claims, and King of the Holy Roman Empire. It was at this time that the German nobility protested the decision which Charles had made at Worms against Luther, and Charles not only said the decision was right, but he also declared Luther an outlaw and instructed the German princes that they were to notify their people that anyone who saw Luther was free to kill him on the spot without fear of any kind of penalty. He returned to Germany now, in control of the whole situation, recognized universally as the legitimate monarch of the Holy Roman Empire, and in 1530 he proposed to preside over a triumphant diet where he would reconcile the whole nation, and worshiping one God in a common religion, they would live at peace with one another. Well, he gets to the Diet of Augsburg, and some of the German princes get up, and they say, we would like to read a statement. And the statement which they read was the Augsburg Confession. You know, Charles tears his hair out. We are divided. The Lutheran heresy has spread. They presented this and said, this is what we believe, and we are open to being convinced that we're wrong. 25th of June, 1530, 3 p.m., it was read in German, and German copy and a Latin copy were handed to him. He, of course, didn't understand a word that was being said. He understood German in a very limited kind of way. He read Latin and understood Latin, but he sat there and they read German, you know, and it was like me listening to Norwegian. He didn't understand a word that was said. The German princes, who were Lutheran, had expected that their statement, which was being presented, would be given equal treatment to any statement that the Catholics would present. What happened was Charles and the Catholic bishops got together and started to prepare a refutation, which they then would hand to the Lutheran princes and tell them, this is it, boys, get in the line. Well, on August 3rd, their statement was ready, and it was read in German also by the emperor's secretary. The emperor then said, everyone must accept this. In response to this, the Lutherans prepared the apology to the Augsburg Confession, which was then read on September the 22nd, wherein they explained why they had written the Augsburg Confession and why they could not accept the confutation. The emperor refused to even listen. He gave them until April 15th to obey. And he told them they were completely wrong. He would neither accept the apology nor even allow it to be read, and the next day he left town. By the 19th of November, which was about a month and a half later, all the Lutherans had left, and the only ones that were left in Augsburg were the Catholic bishops. But the emperor was gone, so there was nothing to be achieved by them also. The Lutherans asked that a general council be convened the next year to settle the matter. Charles asked the Pope to call a general council, and the Pope refused. The next Pope, Paul III, agreed to conduct one in 1537 at Mantua, which is in northern Italy, but he called it for the elimination of the poisonous Lutheran heresy. In anticipation of that general council, Luther wrote the small called articles, which were to be read by the Lutherans to that council and were to be submitted by the Lutherans to be refuted by their opponents. What happened was the council was not conducted. Instead, the council was transferred to Trent, Council of Trent, and it was at the Council of Trent where the Catholic bishops took the Augsburg Confession and the Apology and used this as the basis for a series of topics to formulate the official Catholic doctrine, which is still the official doctrine to this day. And so it was at the Council of Trent that for the first time in its history, the Church formulated its doctrine. Never it had formulated doctrine before, and so at the Council of Trent, you have formulated doctrine. And of course, it was written in the form of, the Lutherans teach the following, this is heresy, we reject it. The Lutherans teach the following, this is heresy, we reject it. And so on. It just went down the line, and it was simply rejection.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
It must have contained something besides rejection, or how could it be a doctrine?
It said, we reject this, we reject this, we reject this. This is the doctrine, this is the doctrine, this is the doctrine. Well, there was neither defense nor refutation. It was simply rejection and assertion.
And then asserting a different doctrine.
Yeah, this is it, right. All right, in the meantime, the Turks were moving west. They conquered Belgrade in 1521. 1522, they had moved farther. They had conquered most of Hungary by 1526. 1529, they were laying siege to Vienna. If they took Vienna, they would have moved right down the Central Valley of Austria and gotten as far as Innsbruck, and and would have swung up another way over to Munich in that particular area. And so life was getting desperate. Charles spent most of his time after the Diet of Worms in getting an army together from the various petty princedoms to fight against the Turks. He was successful in neutralizing them in Western Hungary. The Turks, not being able to advance any farther on land, shifted to the Mediterranean to sea, and they began piracy as well as naval engagements against the West, particularly in the Barbary states, which are the Tunisian area today. They attacked Italy, they attacked the islands of the Mediterranean. Charles gathered a fleet together and sent it out under an admiral whose name everybody knows simply because a ship went down off New York City within our lifetime. The admiral was Andrea Doria, 1535. Finally, in July, they captured Tunis, which was the heartland of the Barbary states. They neutralized that threat, freed 20,000 Christian slaves. Well, in 1535, the Duke of Milan died. He was childless. You can about guess what happened. Francis I decided that would be terrific to add to France. You know, we've played this scenario before. France invades northern Italy once again. Charles beats him. But what happened was he didn't beat him as well as he did the previous time, and so Francis got a hunk of northern Italy. So he got a little piece of the action. Charles tried to get Venice and the Pope to help him with the pirates in North Africa, and they weren't too successful. The German states, surprisingly enough, and nobody's been able to explain why the Germans behaved the way they did with Charles, but the German states were either at peace or helping him. He was never threatened by the German states, and yet they got the worst treatment from him of anybody.
The German states furnished Lutheran soldiers to fight against the Turks under Charles V around Vienna.
Right. And then Charles decided what he was going to have to do was to neutralize France. And so he invaded France from, the traditional route, which has been followed in World War I, followed in World War II. You come across, the lowlands, and you come across Belgium, and you head across the big plain for Paris. France quit the war and gave up northern Italy, big hunk of northeastern France, and they were at peace once again. There was a secret codicil where Francis agreed that he would fight against Protestantism and that he would also attempt to conquer Geneva and win it back for the church from Calvinism. He also accepted the decisions of the Council of Trent and made them official doctrine in France. But all this was a secret agreement with Charles. Then came the small Cauldic Wars, which were reactions to Charles' attempts to impose the decisions of the Council of Trent on the German Lutheran states. Pope paid for the war, Charles fought it. Charles beat the Germans as he'd beaten everybody else. He captured John Frederick of Saxony and Philip of Hesse, who were the two leaders of the German Lutheran princes. He imposed his decision on them, and Philip agreed, and John didn't. Melanchthon got into the action at this point, and he and some of his friends drew up a counter-proposal that they thought would make life livable for them. And as a result of this, they were able to stall for time, and John, who had refused to capitulate to the Charles, was successful in gathering an army, and for the first time, Charles lost a fight. John began moving across Austria at Innsbruck. He captured Innsbruck, and he moved toward Vienna. Charles began to back off, and Henry II was now King of France. He began to move against Charles, and so a kind of pincers movement was beginning to occur in the eastern part of Charles' empire, and he was a smart enough strategist to realize that he better settle for what he could get. And as a result, we get what is known in history as the Religious Peace of Augsburg, which was an agreement between Charles, the King of France, and the German princes that the religion of a territory of the Roman Empire would be identical with the religion of whatever prince was ruling it. In Latin, it's the cuius regio, cuius religio area. With this restriction, it would be either Roman Catholic or Lutheran. The Anabaptists were out, the Calvinists were out. It was either Catholic or Lutheran. And this was a religious peace of Augsburg. Quite obviously, it didn't last too long. But this was in 1555. This was the first time that Charles had been beaten. This was the first time that he didn't dictate the peace terms. For all of the years of fighting in which he had engaged, 35 years, he wasn't much better off than he had been when he started. He was very tired. He was very disillusioned. He couldn't remember a time when he hadn't been involved in a war. And so he decided what he was going to have to do was to dismember his empire into viable hunks, get stable leadership for each one, and retire. And that's what he did. What he found at this time as he began to dismember his empire was that he was still having trouble with Henry II, King of France, who had his army in northern Italy. That Pope Paul IV was against his Spanish rule and giving him trouble in Spain. The Turks had still not been defeated, and the only people that were loyal to him were the Germans. In 1555, in Brussels, he gave the Netherlands to his son Philip II, which was a big mistake. Apart from many other considerations, in miniature form, he gave his son the same headache he'd always had. Here's Spain, here's the Netherlands, France in between. How are you going to rule the two? The only way you can rule them is with a friendly England that lets you go through the English Channel, which, of course, England wouldn't do. So Philip was stuck. Inevitably, Philip had to fight the British for survival. Inevitably, he was going to lose the Netherlands. You could predict it. No, that's what happened. In 1556, he gave him Spain and Sicily. Sicily was a little less of a problem, but she still had the problem of France there. To Ferdinand, he gave the Habsburg Empire, and several years later made him emperor, and that set up the Austrian Habsburg family, which continued until after World War I. In 1557, he retired, and he went to a monastery in Spain. It was an eremitic monastery. In other words, it was a kind of monastery where you were assigned a room and you spent all your time there in prayer and meditation, and you ate very simply and you didn't talk to people. You just remained totally by yourself. He was 57 years old, and he looked like he was 70. He received a few visitors. He wrote to some associations, and he stayed there for a year. He died the 21st of September, 1558, 58 years old. All of his life, he had been very serious. He had been a bit shy, quite self-conscious, no sense of humor whatsoever, and a very plain and simple man. As a youth, he had hoped that he could be the source of reconciliation within the kingdom, and so in the initial years, he was against the decisions of the Council of Trent as too hard-nosed. He felt that Rome did not understand his problems, and so for most of his career, he operated independent or against Rome. Though he was a sober and serious man, he did have time for a little bit of hanky-panky. He had an illegitimate daughter named Margaret, who was born 5 years before he was married. And he had an illegitimate son, interestingly enough, named Don Juan, who was born 6 years after his wife died. He had only one legitimate child, that was Philip II. Even though he was a failure in his own plan to hold Europe together, he was a brilliant success in the New World. That's why I said the other day, you'd be surprised at how much of our history was created by Charles V. For instance, in 1519, he sent out Magellan, who circumnavigated the globe. In 1519, he sent out Cortez, who discovered Mexico and who came to the Pacific Ocean. In 1521, he sent out Ponce de Leon, that's the guy who was looking for the Fountain of Youth, and he discovered Florida, you know, where most of America's elderly people have also discovered the Fountain of Youth. He sent Alvarado to Guatemala and Salvador in 1523. He sent Sebastian Cabot out 1526-30 to Brazil and Argentina. He sent Mendoza out in 1536, and Mendoza established Buenos Aires. He sent out Pizarro 1535. He found Peru. He sent out De Soto in 1539. He found the Mississippi River. He sent out Coronado in 1540, and he found California. So all of these explorers, you know, whose names we have known from history, except Columbus, were all sent out by Charles V. So while he was working on a United States of Europe, at which he did not succeed, at the same time he was exploring the other side of the globe and financing men, and he saw the possibilities that the wealth of the New World could unite the Old World and bring it peace. Well, it never did. But what happened? He used the wealth of the New World to finance his wars. And at the same time, most of the wealth was left for his son Philip II to use to try to carry out his father's plans. And what happened instead was it got squandered, whatever of it the British didn't steal on the high seas or send to the bottom. And then when the wealth in the New World started to disappear, or when they couldn't get it to Spain, that was it. The French, meanwhile, had been exploring Canada and other areas while the British were fighting against the Spanish, and so for a period of time, the French moved to the forefront, but eventually it was the British who got most of it in the 19th century and up until about World War II, and then all of a sudden it was all gone. So Charles V was an extremely influential and important man. Very successful in the New World, very unsuccessful in the Old. And I suspect that he probably never thought very much about Martin Luther. He quite obviously was not impressed by him. He considered him probably a little German troublemaker who was interfering with his grand plans. And I'm sure that those who surrounded him from the papal court didn't do very much to disabuse him of that idea. And I suspect that it was very, very seldom that he made any decisions for religious reasons, other than to see religion as a basis for a united country and a united Europe. And those are the guys who knew Luther. I suppose if we had had six sessions, I might have talked about Katie, who also knew Luther.
Who's
that? Catherine von Bora, ex-nun who married Martin Luther. Okay. But maybe we'll do that some other time.
An excellent series, Bill.
Thank you, Paul.